Hello and welcome to the Oxford Ukraine podcast, a series of podcasts brought to you from the University of Oxford. The Oxford Ukraine Hub is an interdisciplinary network connecting expertise across the University of Oxford with international researchers and practitioners working on Ukraine-related issues. By placing Ukraine at the centre of scholarly inquiry, we aim to disrupt long-established epistemological hierarchies within Slavic and Eastern European studies. Our podcast series brings together diverse voices and perspectives to explore Ukraine's past, present and future through various disciplinary lenses. In 2025 and 2026, we're running a series of seminars. Today's episode features two panellists from our inaugural seminar, Ukrainian Environmentalisms, Perspectives from Science, Policy and Culture. My name's Jonathan Turnbull and I'm a geographer and junior research fellow here at Jesus College, Oxford. I'll be your host today. Today, we're honoured to be joined by two distinguished guests from our culture and art panel, Oksana Seminik, an art historian and decolonial researcher, and Irina Zamaruyeva, an artist and cultural geographer. As we know, Ukraine faces unprecedented environmental challenges. Today, with nearly a third of Ukraine's forests damaged by war, 23 national parks under occupation, and a third of the country mined, the environmental situation has reached a critical point. Ukraine's natural landscape has long been subject to an imperial gaze from outside. Known as the breadbasket of Europe for its nutrient-rich soils, and more recently, of course, as a landscape of rare earth minerals that attract the attention of greedy oligarchs from west and east. Certain notions of wildness are attached to Ukraine's east, but the country is home to many diverse ecological landscapes from the Pelician wetlands in the north to the Carpathian Mountains in the west, to the steppe landscape in the south and east. Art and culture play a key role in how Ukraine as a natural and cultural landscape is mediated both within Ukraine and beyond. Today, we're going to hear from researchers in the cultural and artistic spheres about how they understand Ukrainian ecologies, study environmental history in Ukraine, and how they want to see Ukraine's natural landscapes represented to the world. Oksana, Irina, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Hi there, good to be with you.
So let's kick off with a first question to Oksana. Could you tell us a little bit about the Pelician landscape and how, as an art historian, you became interested in environmental themes there?
Thank you for this question. I think I should start from a very beginning because Pelician landscape is actually my native landscape. I was born there and I was growing up in the small village in Pelissa region, which is not very far away from the zone of alienation. And it's even funny that for me, the kind of real forest is pine forest. And when I say we should go to the real forest, I mean the pine ones, because that's the Pelician landscape I was growing up. And I think when I was little, I didn't realize how Chernobyl history was, how Chernobyl actually impacted my family, myself, and the landscape, and the villages and cities around. Because actually, I became really interested in Chernobyl because of my family story. So my dad, he was born in a small village which is now in the zone of alienation. It's called Novosilki. It's really small village. And he was displayed to the village where my mom lived and where she was born. So the other joke about me is that I was born actually thanks to Chernobyl catastrophe, because that's how they met. I think it was really weird for me for a very long time that people imagine Chernobyl catastrophe as something that happened on 26th of April 1986, and that's it. And then was like maybe 2 weeks or 1 month of liquidation, the consequences of the catastrophe, and then that's it. Because for me, it was more story of this kind of lost paradise, because that's how I imagined Chernobyl zone when we were, for example, gathering together in some family celebrations, and someone all the time should start talking about how great life in Chernobyl was, how mushrooms were better, berries were bigger, I don't know, the nature is different, etc. So I think I became really interested in that topic because I also didn't know what actually happened. And I didn't know, for example, why, I don't know, many people believe that taking, you know, that eating mushrooms and berries from our forests, that's not even in the border of the zone of alienation, but closer to Kyiv, Bucha, Borodyanka. It was also kind of, it was not safe and it was strange for me. So that's how, oh, but also the main part is that no one ever tried to research the image of Chernobyl catastrophe in Ukrainian art. And that's what I'm doing now, still researching and working on that topic. So it's more like art history, but also maybe just history of the catastrophe too. And I think it's, and for me, it's really interesting to work on this different fields with different people like geographers, ecologists, I don't know, physics, etc. So I hope I answered the question somehow.
I think so. Yeah.
Long.
No, thank you. That's it's a fascinating story, and it's great to hear about your connections to the landscape that you're actually writing about, and also the landscape where I've been working as well. I'm fascinated with a particular artist from the Chernobyl region, Maria Primachenko, and I know you are too. And so I was wondering if you could tell us more about Maria and how, through her art, you're able to tell a story about the environmental history of Polesia.
So what I also forgot to mention is that when the first time I went to Chernobyl zone, it was, I don't remember, I was like 13, maybe 14 years old. And it was the time when previously, before the COVID happened, you could enter the zone with your family to visit the graves of your relatives. And of course, to see what's going on with the houses, etc. And I remember that feeling, and I think it's very important, that the nature was so beautiful and everything was so like flourishing. And I was so surprised because before that, I thought, you know, I was thinking about Chernobyl zone as something like nothing is growing up there because of the radiation and it's look very dark, I don't know, gray. And the villages are ruined, etc. But then I was surprised that it's so flourishing and so nice and so beautiful. And I felt there like it's my home, which was weird because I've never been there before. But it's like, it's such a strong connection with the landscape. And turning back to Maria Primachenko, I think that's why I liked her even before I've started my deep research on her artworks and on her history. Now I'm writing a book. I almost finished it. So anyway, sometimes I even look at her and think that she's kind of my, you know, granny or something, because she feels her artwork, it's so, I feel this deep connection. And I think it's also because of this Polesian landscape, because she was born and lived her whole life in the small village Bolotnia. It's near Ivankiv, and it's just 10 kilometers from the beginning of the exclusion zone, zone of alienation, Chernobyl zone. And she, when the Chernobyl catastrophe happened, she decided to stay there because for her, the nature around was the most inspiring and powerful thing. So without this police and landscape, it's kind of she couldn't exist and she couldn't create artworks. And I think it's interesting that she also was one of these few artists who started to create artworks about the ecological problems after Chernobyl catastrophe. Because as many people know or they do not know, that the topic of Chernobyl catastrophe was actually censored after during the Soviet Union, because like their, I don't know, propaganda was that nothing actually bad happened. People will come back to these villages in 3 years. Everything is fine. No one got like injured. No one died because of the radiation, except for like 31 firefighters, and everything is okay. And so Primachenko, actually many art historians, they believe that she's a naive artist, but I don't think she was that naive, as you know, many people want us to see her, because she signed each of her artworks with these long titles that actually reveal the allegorical nature of her paintings. So, and each of her paintings actually has a message. So for example, talking about the Chernobyl catastrophe, actually she's created at least 36 artworks, and still I'm researching, I'm finding new ones. So maybe it's 40, maybe it's 50. We still need to find out this. And it's interesting that her productivity started after the Chernobyl catastrophe. And it's also important to say that she was almost 80 years old. So she was kind of, it was hard for her to continue working, to continue creating artworks. But after this catastrophe, she decided to create as many artworks as possible her phrase, to show how beautiful the world was before this catastrophe, and how beautiful actually still this world is. So you need to, you know, fight for it. You need to save it. You need to cherish the nature, the world, etc. And it's interesting that so she also created this kind of ecological artworks. And for example, some of her artworks, it's like two animals talking about the contaminated water, or for example, contaminated grass. So, and I'll just read the title of one paintings that says, "A police and catfish climbed out of the pond into the forest looking for clean water, and we don't have it." So it's like she was trying to show how even the lives of the animals changed. And the other thing that really impressed me, and I think it will be the last thing that I'll say about Primachenko for now, because I'm talking too much. So it's interesting that many people believe that after the catastrophe, in the zone of alienation, it would be nothing but this kind of just a dead land without anything, without any birds, any animals, I don't know, any flourishing trees, etc. But in 1982, she created a memorial painting in which birds fly over a nuclear reactor covered in flowers. And the next generation come to honor the memory of the heroes. So the flowers symbolized that she believed that the land at Chernobyl will be reborn. And the title of the paintings says, "That's how the fourth block dreamed. Flowers will grow on it, and the children will carry flowers. As a monument that will forever be near it, doves will fly in. Our heroes saved us. They left us." So, and also, she said in many interviews that she had this dream that everything will be really good and Ukraine will still flourish and the radiation will not harm us. So I think it's really interesting that while scientists were still thinking how the Chernobyl zone will look like, she believed that that actually nature will feel very good without people.
Thank you, Oksana. It's fascinating to hear you speak about Maria Primachenko. I'm just thinking a little bit about what the environmental humanities scholar and anthropologists Daria Tsimbaliuk and Tanya Richardson say about the image of Chernobyl as a post-apocalyptic wasteland coming to stand in for the Ukrainian landscape in general. And I think that can cast kind of a negative view of Ukraine from the outside. But through the stories of Primachenko and even the aesthetic of the bright colours and the animals that talk to each other, we can kind of tell a more positive story in some ways, regardless of what the science says, because the science about Chernobyl is still a very hot topic in many ways. So it's really interesting to hear about how Maria Primachenko's work tells a different story to the one that most people are used to hearing from things like the Stalker video games and that kind of thing. I'm also fascinated by your work with other artists from the Pelusian region, including those who have just traveled there and lived there and visited from Kyiv and other places. And, you know, you've talked to us before about how the Pelusian landscape made such an impression on the lives and work of these artists. And so I'd just love to hear a little bit more about how the nuclear catastrophe and the zone affected some of the artists that you work on. And how has Chernobyl thus changed perceptions of nature in Pelusia?
Thank you for this question. I mean, why this topic of image of Chernobyl catastrophe is really interested for art historians is that show nuclear catastrophe and the radiation is more difficult than to show, for example, war. Because first of all, you don't have this kind of generational images of other artists, for example, who created many artworks before you. So you cannot kind of even start the dialogue with them, for example. And on the other hand, radiation is invisible. So it's invisible enemy. And of course, when you can look at something, a tree, animal, person, you could not see sometimes that this kind of this life impacted by radiation. So I think it's very interesting that how those artists, how they were trying to show it, and how they, with which images they were working, and how it impacted us right now in 2025. Because, for example, of course, as you mentioned, the game Stalker, it's a really good, you know, it's a really good example, because this Stalker game became kind of worldwide. So it's not only, you know, for Ukrainians and how we imagine the catastrophe or the alienation zone. But it's how really many people imagine the Chernobyl catastrophe and the zone itself. But usually it's also almost a lot of this kind of, I would say, media projects. And this, we can mention, I don't know, some contemporary projects or some movies, games, photographs. It's usually about Pripyat and just the this kind of apocalyptic landscape, as you said, when we see abandoned houses, where we see just, these dark colors. And now I'm thinking about, for example, this photographer who was also a liquidator during the first years, I would say, of the catastrophe. It's Yuri Kosin, and he created many photographs during the years. He actually, I think he was coming back to the zone almost every year and photographed many things. But if you look at his landscape, it's usually have some signs of the people of the I don't know, civilization that existed before, but almost never just the kind of clean nature without any houses or some things, whatever. But then when we are looking at the painted landscapes of Petro Yemets, who was also a liquidator, and he painted, of course, abandoned village as well, but also one of the most common images of Chernobyl catastrophe is apple tree. So it has a lot of so he painted this apple tree with so many apples on it that it's cover all the ground, that it but no one, of course, eating them, no one collecting them. And I think it's very this powerful image of I call the poisoned landscape, because you look at this landscape, you look at these apple trees, but it's not the regular one. You understand that it's poisoned by radiation. So that's why no one is eating these apples, or no one is growing up anything on these gardens. So it's kind of for me, it's interesting, these poisoned landscapes, when we look at something that just regular landscape, and you cannot even say that here is something different, but you understand it, that it's about this, hidden danger, I would say. And now, if we are talking about, contemporary times, is the same with the mined territory. You cannot say that there is a mine, under under the grass or somewhere else. So, but you understand that if in that village were Russians or were some war, if the village or city was a war zone once, you can look at this and imagine that probably it's mine territory. It's not safe. It's also poisoned, but now it's poisoned by war. And it's quite interesting that Chernobyl zone now is not only dangerous because of the radiation, but it's also dangerous because of this kind of presence that Russians left, because it's not safe anymore, for example, even for ecologists to go wherever they want, because it's not clean territories. It's just dangerous for them. So I would probably recommend to look at this. But coming back to artists and photographers, I think I'm still working on the topic of the landscape and the Chernobyl, because of course, many people, for them, it was the catastrophe that impacted people in the first place. And the second one was like nature that suffered from all of that. And also, because of the censorship, you can see how many artworks were actually created on a religious topic, or they were looking at the a Chernobyl catastrophe as apocalypses. So it's kind of also hidden from, so you should, I mean, I should research better, but it's also shows how people how they imaged this catastrophe and what it was for them. So it was not an ecological problem in the first place. They were scared of the the people lives. And just to add and to finish that, remember you made this, you contacted me with this school students from the New Mexico. It was very interesting because so we were talking and someone asked, like, how do you think, what was, what, like, so what do you think was worst? That Chernobyl impacted the land and now you cannot, use it, the impact on the health or the impact on, I don't remember, I think it was ecology or something like this. And I think, and I said, like, I don't know why, but this question about the land that you cannot use for me was very, I would say, weird, because like it's the last thing that I'm thinking about, that you cannot use this land for growing up, for agricultural, which was also before the Soviet Union, it was not agricultural region. So they were trying to change this landscape since the, I don't know, the maybe 50s or the 60s, when they were just cutting off the forest and tried to make some collective farms and to grow up something there, which was strange because it was never, it's not like in Vinnytsia region to have all this really good what do you call it, chernozem,
black earth.
So like where you have this really great land for growing up something.
Fertile soil.
Yeah, I hope that makes sense.
It does. Thank you. I really found this idea of, the nature not appearing quite as it seems. It's become weird in the Chernobyl zone for some reason. And I've heard that described as a crisis of the aesthetic, where the aesthetic no longer corresponds to what is actually out there. But these responses were fascinating, and I look forward to talking more about them as we go through this podcast. I'm going to introduce Irina now. We're really pleased to have you with us and love the way that your work combines artistic and historical methods to shine a light on Ukrainian ecologies and environments. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you became interested in environmental themes in Ukraine.
Yeah, thank you so much, Johnny. Thanks so much for having me here. I do like also starting with, locating myself in the landscape. I really enjoyed, Oksana, you talking about your relationship with your the place where you're from. I am from what is today called Kropivnitsky. When I grew up there, it was called Kirovohrad, which is in the central Ukraine. And I wish I had some kind of story to tell you of how I was so into nature and landscapes when I was there, but the truth is that I wasn't. I was quite bored of the landscape that was all around. I grew up in a city. I remember lots of like vastness and flatness that would kind of pass by outside of the window. Now that I think of it, it's of course were mass fields of wheat and corn and sunflower and all of that. But as a kind of, growing up there, it didn't particularly grasp my attention. The only thing that was kind of prominent that I remember thinking a lot about already kind of at a young age is that we would joke at school that we would be people who are lit up at night because we're so full of uranium, because Kropyvnytskyi is the only town, I don't know if it's in the world, but definitely in Ukraine, who stands on the like active like uranium mine. So we kind of had a sense that, okay, there is some crazy weird thing that is being dug basically under us. How will we be affected? But of course, it was just more like a joke thing. We didn't know kind of much about it. Yeah, shines in a very different light today. But then I did do a bachelor's degree in ecology in Kyiv, and that led me eventually to also doing a master's in sustainability, where for a while I had this kind of split where I was interested in all things ecological, all things climate, and on the other hand, there was all the artistic and creative work. And in Ukraine, I didn't really bring those together. It was only when I did the kind of, yeah, wrote my thesis with a professor of cultural geography in Kiel in Germany, and that allowed me to think more critically about all these topics that I was thinking about, but kind of separating them. Here's climate, here's nature, here's ecology. And yeah, the disciplines of like political ecology and cultural geography gave me more of a conceptual apparatus and vocabulary to grasp what is going on. And that kind of, yeah, led me to combine these different artistic and research methods to more recently look at the environmental history and political ecology, both of places at home, but also in Scotland, which is where I'm currently based. I've been working with specific plants more recently to explore these different topics. I've worked with Adonis vernalis, or in Ukrainian, it's Горецвіт весняний, and my kin region, looking kind of how the history is narrated, how do we acknowledge all of the other creatures that with us make this history, not just as the passive backdrop to which things are happening. I've worked also here in Scotland with geranium, and that was a photographic project looking at militarization and landscapes. And more recently, I've been working with rapeseed. And that's kind of an attempt to tell both the historic, the ecological, and political stories, and look at these forces that shape Ukraine's landscapes. Think about the work it takes, think about the habitats they make and unmake. Yeah, I guess I'm also a co-editor of the Commons Journal, Spilne, where I'm also trying to bring more of this ecological materialist analysis to what we publish. But I guess broadly, the kind of what this all of this can be described as me being dissatisfied with things being talked about as purely economic or purely ecological or purely cultural, and try to find forms for both collective but also personal reckoning with the scale of the crisis that we're dealing with. And now it's about, yeah, trying to grasp the ongoing acute violence of the war in Ukraine, but also see that somehow in perspective and in relation to all the lurking slow violence that the place and the people have been experiencing for centuries, really.
Thank you. It's fascinating to hear about this sort of personal history, and I'm surprised to hear that you weren't originally interested in ecological themes, because there seems to be such attentiveness and care that comes through when I read your work. And on that note, you used the term kin region, and I wondered if you could just briefly explain what that means for people who would be unfamiliar with that term.
Yeah, sure. So kin region comes from doing this work with Adonis vernalis, with Horacivita Visnani, where I learned about this plant actually in the book that I brought home with me from Ukraine to Scotland. There was just a picture of this plant in there, and I got fascinated and interested in it and started to research it. But what also caught my attention in this book that is written as this quite ecological kind of like pop ecology type of a book, they often use the word of Rydny Kraj, which is I translated as kin region into English, because there is a way of speaking in Ukrainian about a place that is dear to you, that is your. It often people talk about it as their birthplace, is where they come from, but it could also be a place that they've made home kind of later in life. And so Reed, an Ukrainian, is kin in English. And I just really love the fact that you can talk about a place as something that is of your kin. So the same way that you would talk about your relatives, your wider family, there is that slip that Ukrainian language allows you to, that it's both people and other places and creatures that you can fold into that. And the second part, kraj, is that can mean a place, but also an edge. So it also has this kind of shape-shifting nature. And I think it's a nice way to kind of destabilize also the scales at which we're thinking about, that it's not like the city or the village or the region or the oblast or the kind of the given geographical imaginary of a territorial unit, but it's kind of something that escapes and is so much more than kind of that confined place.
Yeah, that's it's beautiful to hear that story told so eloquently. You've worked in and with some steppe regions too, and there's quite prevalent imaginaries of the steppe as being an empty wilderness landscape that now dominate the way many people envisage various parts of Ukraine, especially the south and east. I wondered if you could tell us more about where these imaginaries come from and why you might consider them to be problematic.
Yeah, so in my own archival work, I have been looking quite a lot at what has been happening to what is currently the Ukraine before Soviet Union, so kind of the time of the late Russian Empire, 1880s, 1890s. And there in the publications, statistical publications from the 1886, I've encountered descriptions of the steppe as like as boundless, or the steppe as a place that has no mountains, or a quote from one of these statistical reports that the entire horizon has no hill to rest the gaze on. And further, the author of the report goes on to complain about how monotonous it is. So just, yeah, it's quite striking to kind of, you look at a place and you see what's not there, you see what's lacking, you see the kind of some kind of emptiness. And this, it's not just kind of that symbolic emptiness. It took a very particular twist at the kind of this golden age of statistics, also like the 1880s, 1890s time, because the context in which these imaginaries are rooted are the time when Russian Empire was very busy surveying the land that it acquired relatively recently, the contemporary Ukrainian, southern Ukrainian places. So the kind of the purpose of those records that we currently have that narrate the steppes as empty come from a place of needing to account for what do we have, how does it serve our economy, how can it feed the growing empire. And that's something that the historian Anna Olonenko has written extensively about. She has fascinating research on the afforestation of central Ukrainian lands. So basically, the Russian Empire trying to plant forests in those places to supply wood for the Imperial Navy, because that was still the time when ships were built of wood, so you needed a lot of wood. Didn't work. It was a bad plan. They gave up on that plan, but you can still see the remains of the pine forests in those areas. Like by Kropotnitsky, there is one where my parents still go and walks there, but it's kind of the wider history of that is trying to make sure there's enough resources for the growing empire. And also that it's Luke has been writing about how the steppes were never empty, and there were all these people living there, and the nomadic people and those who've temporarily settled in those places. And a lot of this focuses on the imaginary of the place that is empty, but what I'm interested in this is more the materiality of it. It's not the way it's just seen as voids, is that the growing empire needed to satisfy its expansion ambitions. It needed to strengthen its position in the international trade. And therefore, every place, everybody that did not contribute to this aim had to be transformed. And by that, I mean made productive, made to work for the empire. And that means, the steppe creatures, plants are growing. We can't export them. We can't turn them into a profitable commodity. Therefore, this is all turning into agricultural land. We need to up the production. So it's kind of, yeah, I think important in that story to hold both kind of the symbolic kind of imaginary, but also what that meant materially and economically and politically.
Thank you. Your research is unique in the way that it brings together different methods for studying environmental history. So I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about how you managed to combine your artistic practice with more traditional methods of doing environmental history.
Yeah, that's a good question because I think I feel most of the time that my work doesn't quite fit anywhere because it's a bit of everything. I think, well, primarily it's kind of, yeah, the writing and the photography, that the two kind of big kind of methodological ways that I think about it. But I'm a big, like, Donna Haraway's work and way of thinking has had a huge influence on me. And there is this kind of more, she has this term of like implosion in one of her works where you start with a particular thing or being a plant in a rapeseed recently, in my case, for example, and you try to like comprehend as many dimensions of it as possible. So for me, that includes looking at the actual botany of the plant itself, the soil science, Ukraine's land legislation, the international trade data, the pesticides and fertilizer statistics, because there's something about how, I suppose, how specialist the knowledge is currently, and I feel such a lack of like connections being made across these kind of vast areas of knowledge that are out there. So it's an attempt to kind of see a more whole story. So hence, kind of the drawing on like a huge amount of like disciplines and ways of knowing a place. And the second one, the historic one, is a very important one because the archival work, so working directly with the archival sources, but also reading the works of other historians, is about, for me, seeing the continuities rather than mere disruptions. Because I think it's with the war, it's there's kind of this discourse around like the rupture or disruption, which is true in some case, but I'm trying to kind of see how that fits into the more of the continuity of various scales of harm or various scales of just making life in a place. It's, yeah, and with the photography, because I also photograph in most of these places that I go to, I work with both analog and digital film. That's, I suppose, a way that I love language. Language is very important for me, but I also don't believe that it's kind of finite and everything could be expressed in language. Hence trying to think through images, also trying to think through more embodied way of knowing a place. Like, it's very important for me to actually go and walk in the rapeseed field, and it's, you all of a sudden get a sense of like, wow, it all smells like cabbage. It's this very, very intense smell, and walking through it is not a very easy thing to do. So yeah, there's like layers of what it means to know a place, and that I'm all trying to combine, which is sometimes I get very tangled, and it's a very similar being tangled in this, trying to articulate the story as being tangled walking in the rapeseed field, because it's hard to make a few steps without getting completely tangled in its branches.
Yeah, well, I think you tell the stories very clearly, despite drawing from all of these different things. And I've been there myself when you feel like you're in a mess of data and different ways of looking at something, and how do you get them to speak together? And I think you do it really, really beautifully. I'm going to ask you a little bit of a harsh question to finish. Like choosing a favorite member of your family, I wondered what your favorite kin species is in your kin region, Kropivnitsky. Do you have a particular favorite kin in this landscape?
It's such a good question, Joanie. Thank you for it. And yeah, quite an impossible one to answer. But one that I think is interesting to think about is how, because I've been thinking so much about the rapeseed, so it's going to be related to rapeseed, and it's the relationship that rapeseed has with other crops. So because rapeseed, together with wheat and corn and soy and sunflower, constitute top Ukraine's export crops, and what that means in terms of the landscape, or more specifically, who rapeseed's neighbors are, it's not so much like steppe vegetation or other creatures, but it's other other crops. I was talking to a farmer recently who grows rapeseed in central Ukraine, and I asked him to tell me where does rapeseed cultivation begin? And I was fascinated by his answer because he said, first, you harvest the wheat. And that kind of blew my mind because I thought he might start talking about the seeds or the planting, but no, it starts with another crop because in Ukraine, there is no, like the crop rotation cycles are not really a thing, unfortunately. So you plant one crop after the other, and it's that continuity of what comes before rapeseed and what comes afterwards that I thought this kind of that kind of brief answer or the beginning of that answer gave me a lot to think about, and it made me think a lot about much kind of bigger time scales as well of what does it mean to grow, cultivate things responsibly. What if you see not just a plant, but a plant in time, and what its kind of affinities that it cultivates deliberately or not. Yeah, so many things that I could also talk about, but maybe I'll stick with just this example.
Thank you, thank you. I want to bring you both into a conversation now, and both of you have spoken variously about how Ukraine has been subject to an imperial gaze, imperial colonial powers, and the way the Polesian region was engineered and infrastructured and tried to be turned into an agricultural land and failed. Same with the woodland in the center of Ukraine, and then the vision of the steppe and its conversion into this productive landscape. And we see today with talks of a mineral deal in Ukraine that the landscape once again is being viewed by outside powers as a colonial resource from which to be extracted from. And beyond the works you've already mentioned, do you have any examples of artists that deal with this theme well? Could you explain how these works put forward another vision of the Ukrainian landscape?
I think first, I do have an example, but I also want to kind of make a brief comment on kind of how we imagine this extractivism or harm, because it's the mineral deal, which is now kind of not clear if it's still on the table, if the conversation somewhat moved on to kind of the atomic control over the nuclear power stations. But the important thing not to forget in this conversation that if you look at who has been the major investor into Ukraine's economy or to Ukraine over the past a couple of decades, it's Cyprus. And it's Cyprus not because Cyprus people are kind of investing into Ukraine, it's because it's Ukrainian agriculture, sorry, not agricultural, oligarchic holdings, including agricultural, including metallurgical, chemical industries, all sorts, have been practicing this kind of extractivism we're talking about for a while, where a tiny amount of profits that are getting back to Ukraine via this offshore holdings is happening. So it's kind of it's a new level that we're experiencing now, but it's not new, and seeing that in continuity is important. And the artist that comes to mind in the question, and also in relation to seeing these continuities for me, is Yana Kononova, who is a Ukrainian photographer. And I just love her photography in general, the way that she approaches landscape. But in particular, I'm thinking about her project Desperation of Landscape, which is her exploration of environmental consequences of the Russia-Ukrainian war. But in that, she kind of goes beyond the kind of traditional documentation of war as this kind of combat zone, this kind of more the images that you think of, or the kind of the post deoccupied territories or post kind of active conflict areas. She kind of has this beautiful way of collaging the industrial and the geological histories into one frame. And as a fellow photographer, I understand also that it's never possible to tell like a ginormous whole history within one frame. But kind of when you work with this bodies of work with kind of the whole series as she does, I think there's a very important story that you can see there about the continuities and the layeredness of extractivism that we can't simply pinpoint to it's just them. She kind of stays true to that very complex, very messy, very grim entanglement, and somehow it's beautiful in its very, very grim way, and that's what I really love about it.
Yeah, and also I want to start with the with just some comments that, by the way, my so brother of my grandfather, he moved to Kropyvnytskyi when he was in the military, so I had relatives there, and I was there too, and I was just visiting them. But it's interesting that he decided he had this choice to live somewhere in like closer to his native village, or to move to Kropyvnytskyi, and he decided to move there because I think, I mean, no one ever talked about that or explained that he didn't actually like living in the village. So he was trying to, you know, move like to the city. And it's interesting that after Chernobyl catastrophe, he was the one who, so he came to this village with what do you call it, like a dosimeter, just this
Radiation measuring device.
yeah, radiation measurement device, and he had that because he was in the military, and he checked everything because, of course, no one did that before. Like, you know, no one cared about the people in the villages. And he said, "Oh my God, there is like a huge radiation, especially near the like blocks of concrete." Yes.
Concrete.
So he said that near the concrete blocks, it was that huge radiation. So yeah. Anyway, it's just that I wanted to say, and I think it's really interesting what you said, and that you're researching these military landscapes, because I guess when you know, we can look at these landscapes, military or impacted by like catastrophes, I don't know, Kahovka or Chernobyl catastrophe, or the other thing that is also very interesting, but I think it was such a censored topic that no one ever shown this actually building of these dams on the Dnipro River. So it's a huge trauma for people who lost their houses and their land and cemeteries and just everything. It changed the landscape. It's like it was a huge thing, but you almost never will see some reflections on the Ukrainian art at that period of time, except for just building these things, like the Soviet propaganda of, you know, looking at landscape as something only for using, only for building new factories, or, you know, something like this. And so I think it's very interesting just in general to look at the landscape art in the Ukrainian art history and, you know, look at this, comparing to the historical times, what was, and political history, and you know what was going on at that time. Because also the other great example, it's actually Margarita Selska. She was Jewish Ukrainian artist, and she came to Crimea in 1950s, so after the deportation of Crimean Tatars. And you can see that there is, so she painted this like empty landscapes, empty houses. So she actually, you know, she tried to she tried to show this tragedy by the landscape. But of course, at that time, you just look at this and like, oh, Crimean landscapes, what a nice what a nice artworks. So I think, and we can talk a lot about examples like this. So I think when we're thinking about artworks about war or landscapes or impact of the war on something, on cities, on the, I don't know, landscapes, maybe we should also focus not only on the artists who focus on that topic, but also on those people who just they're not even, you know, maybe thinking about that, that they're creating this war landscape. But of course, the artist that I really like is Katarina Alinik, who's creating this kind of very, I would say, like traumatic landscape of her native Donbas region, where dead bodies becoming kind of, you know, part of the soil. And I think it's also a great metaphor for, you know, Ukrainian soil and land in general, because we're almost every time on the center of some tragical events. First World War, Second World War, Holocaust, Holodomor, now the war that we have. So it's like sometimes we're just looking at this peaceful landscape, but it could be, for example, and it, sometimes it is, a place of some events that happened, I don't know, decades ago, but still, you cannot just ignore this context. You cannot take out this landscape and say, oh, look how gorgeous it is, and not, you know, thinking about what actually happened there and why maybe artists not eventually decided to create this landscape.
Yeah, it's really interesting you bring that up. Sorry, Karina.
Yeah, can I just add to that quickly? Because it's such a fascinating way that Oksana, you speak about this kind of the lack of certain narratives in the artworks that makes me think about the deceptiveness of image. Because I think there's still in some ways the expectation that the painting or photograph just depicts what is there, but also fundamentally what are all the things that are not there that are, I guess, yeah, the work of us as researchers or historians or artists or whoever that helps contextualize that work in the world that it was taking place. And the Kachovka example that you were talking about also reminds me of the work of the historian whom I mentioned before, Anna Olonenko, because she has this amazing article on the construction of the Kachovka dam that draws a lot on the oral histories. And I think oral histories is also another really fascinating source to work with, where it's full of reflections of how people experience the construction of the dam. And there's this very evocative image there where the article is titled Nove Nasze More, Nove Nasze Gore. So it's our new sea is our new grief. And there's a lot of this in folklore kind of narratives of that, the equation of the sea and the grief of komore, komore, for some it's the sea, for some it's the grief of zbudovali more ludziom na gore, they build the sea for people's grief. It's kind of very, very powerful, but again, it's very easy for these narratives to stay tucked away into the kind of historical archives, and it's amazing to have people who are kind of working to reactualize them, to bring them in new context, like what you were doing with Promachenko's work as well. Yeah, I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, it's what's not there when we're looking at this landscape. I think it could be really interested artistic project to take some landscapes that, you know, we're looking at them as you said, for example, when we were looking at Kachovka Dam, Kachovka Sea, or how they call even Kiev Sea, which is this Kiev Dam near Vyshgorod. So you can look at the landscapes just of the water, but you should, you know, understand that maybe someone could put some archive photographs behind, so we can see that behind of that, under that, it's whole villages, it's people's stories there, and also nature, I don't know, so many things. Yeah.
And there's, I guess, there's a Ukrainian writer, Taras Prochasko. He has this term because he writes a lot about like landscapes and his relationship and people's relationship to nature. He's a writer now, but he's originally trained as a forester, so he draws a lot on the kind of the forestry connections. And he has this notion of like a primary landscape that he talks about, kind of a thing that you are used to seeing when you grow up, and that becomes your reference point or like your benchmark. And I've been thinking a lot with that because at some point it struck me that I, for a long time, was thinking that, well, these kind of never-ending sunflower fields, that's just what it is. But the more I look into it with the research and with thinking critically about why there is this never-ending sunflower field, there's all these wider histories to it that you don't see just looking in the landscape and kind of seeing landscape as historical and seeing nature as historical and like produced in these various ways is very, very important.
Certainly, I think these are fascinating conversations, so related to a lot of the work that we've all been doing, and some key geographical concepts. For example, you mentioned what the landscape hides, and that's been a question in cultural geography for decades, around the duplicity of landscape. And in the British context, we often think about it in relation to how landscaped gardens were designed to show wealth, but then the labour that went into producing these dramatic featured gardens is erased from the picture. The painting in the end might just feature the landowners, but you don't see the workers. And in the Ukrainian context, you've got different landowning histories, and so it would be really interesting to see more what the duplicity of landscape is in that context. Irina and I have talked a little bit about this before, but I think it's a really fascinating area for future work. Also, this kind of primary landscape makes me think of shifting baseline syndrome, and the idea that what you're used to growing up experiencing nature kind of naturalizes, and you get used to that as what should be protected. But what if that environment that you think is natural and should be protected is already very degraded? So a lot of these artworks that we're talking about are attempting somewhat to kind of rehistoricize and restory a landscape and ecology back in time to a state that, while it's still chosen, it's still produced, might be one that is more desirable or sought after. And one more brief thing is, it's interesting that you've both brought up the Kakhovka Dam. I think the photography of Daria Svitolova on Kakhovka's aftermath of the destruction of the dam is very evocative of how the landscape is changing and the environmental effects that have gone on there. But we can talk a little bit maybe about the reforestation of the Kakhovka landscape, and what we're seeing there and the stories that are starting to emerge very much mirror what we saw at Chernobyl. It's the ability of nature to somehow bounce back after catastrophe. I wondered if you've seen any resonances there.
I do, of course, but also, I don't know, just, I remembered how I've learned what happened with Kakhovka Dam, and then I was thinking that, oh, so now we will see how, maybe how art will reflect on that catastrophe. So, for example, so we can track, so someone, some researchers, some art historians could track this, how it changes, which images you choose, etc. But then I realized that it's actually very different, but I think it's different because we have so many dramatic events going on almost like every day that you cannot. I mean, I'm talking about like artists, maybe art historians, of course, with like scientists who works with ecology, it's different. But here, I think there is so many things going on that you cannot reflect only on this one thing. So it's like, so for example, if that somehow would happen, like without war, then probably we could trace this very similar, I don't know, ideas or topics or like views on the catastrophe in contemporary Ukrainian art. But now it's hard to now it has now, now it's hard to say, and I think it's also we should talk more on war in general and how artists reflect on that. And maybe, of course, on war landscape, for example. And here I remember all this documentary photography was like, remember that field in Kharkiv region that was just so we could see like this how the land was just bombed. And you could see like many, many, many spots of these bombs. And it's just, it's horrible because also you realize how poisoned this land will be, because it's not only danger to people, but it's also like it's all this like war, it's trash from the war, something like this. I'm not the person who's like studying this topic, so I don't know how it's to explain correctly on terminology, but it stays on the land. So anyway, I think it's more documented now than comparing to Chernobyl, for example, because Chernobyl exclusion zone was, of course, it was super censored and super hard to get there. And it was only like five, maybe six photographers who were working on the very first days. And then the liquidators who were artists, and they were creating some artworks, and all other artworks were just, you know, imagination of the artists, how they imagined what was going on. But with Kachovka, but on the other hand, we don't know what's going on in the occupation. We cannot see, for example, and here is this great example of how art impacted by this Kakhovka Dam is destruction of Polina Rajko House. She was an amazing, naive Ukrainian artist. She started painting at like 60 years old, and she painted all over her house. So her house itself was an artwork. And now it's and now this like is destroyed because of course, the water was almost like half of the house, and Oleshki is still occupied, so no one could get there and at least save some you know some frescoes from the house. So yeah, I don't know if that makes any sense of comparing these two events and the artist's response. Yeah, so I think it's more like documentary. So now I think many artists working with like documentation of what happened than on reflection. Probably people would reflect on what's going on after, because it's really hard to, you know, reflect on all those things when the next day something horrible happens. The next week something horrible happens. The next month something horrible happens. You cannot just, yeah, it's just hard psychologically, I would say.
Yeah, I just wanted to that as well, that I find it and on one hand I really understand this desire to see the forest growing on the former bottom of the Kakhovka Dam as this kind of positive nature regeneration project. And I think there are some ecologists who are like very excited about this, saying that, well, this is the like the biggest naturally growing forest in Europe now and all of these things. But it really also concerns me, I suppose, because it rests similarly as this kind of being very optimistic about like nature coming back to to itself in Chernobyl, that it rests on some imaginary of there's this nature out there that we can leave alone and that will somehow bounce back to some imaginary pristine state. And I think we're very, very far beyond of any kind of notion of untouched or kind of uncontaminated or nature that is separate from human influence. It's you don't have to go into the whole what is Anthropocene and all of that conversation, but there's just some really profound thing about there's some of these chemicals circulating in these places, the pesticides that they've also found on the bottom of this, the agrochemicals, the very poisonous one, and these mutations of the living bodies that we don't see, kind of coming back to what we talked about, what's not there, kind of we can see that as a kind of the forest that's being regenerated or the kind of things look green, therefore to our human eye, they may look healthy. But if you look at it from kind of more this plant perspective and its whole body is mutated and kind of it appears as a normal healthy plant, but actually there's so insane mess that's going on with its body. So I suppose, yeah, I would like to see this as an as a time for us to think about what these mutations that are caused and kind of how all of the toxicity that was spilled with the water, because it wasn't just water, right? It was just all of these chemicals that were poured into this water by some factories, by some agrochemical firms. They're all part of it, and that all flowed into the Black Sea now and kind of carried this toxicity elsewhere. So it's yeah, it's a very, very grim, I suppose, story that also needs to be seen alongside the regeneration or kind of comprehended in ways that are not accessible to us visually.
Yeah, I see there's a problem with the return of nature, as if what is returning is what was there before. We're never going to see that. That's not possible, given that, as you said, nature's always produced in a historical moment. We can think about the Red Forest in Chernobyl example, for example, which was a pine forest in the Pilsen region. It was cut down after the catastrophe because it was so contaminated. And what naturally, in quotation marks, what naturally regenerated was a birch forest of deciduous trees because they were more tolerant of the radiation in the soil. So what came up after itself was a process of kind of emergence, sorry, this kind of emergent ecology that's always going to be quite adapted or specific and situated to a particular milieu. And that's not to say anything of, the people who used to live in these places that are now being celebrated by some. And so there's a real tension there between what we kind of find hope in and what we find where we could find joy in positivity, and also what requires mourning and what should be not celebrated perhaps, and whether ambivalence is a more appropriate orientation to some of these stories. It's a very, very difficult question. So I think to kind of somewhat summarize some of this, I would like to ask what does give you hope for Ukraine's environmental future? Why do you both think that, art and cultural research are so important for tackling some of Ukraine's environmental challenges? These are fields that most often are left to climate scientists or ecologists, but we're talking about much broader terms here.
I don't know. I think my granny actually gives me hope of environmental future, because she still has land where she growing up a lot of things, like potatoes, grains, strawberries, tomatoes, onions, a lot of things, and I think it's a very hard question, but I want to believe that that because so many people in Ukraine used to how to I don't know how to live peacefully with the nature, I would say something like this, that they will probably, one day realize how important some ecological initiatives are, and that even looking at my granny, that she changes a lot of things that she used to do, but when she realized that it's not like okay, and it's for example, like to start fire with that old what do you call it? Not grass, but like, for example, when we are harvesting potatoes, and then this like you have the sticks from the potatoes that are growing up, you know, not under. So potato grows up under, and the above it's like this like green things, but then it became gray and just dry, and you cannot use it for, I don't know, whatever, or like corn, for example, as well. And she was just like starting a fire and just, but when she understood that it's not okay for like the environment, she decided just to stop that and to try just to throw away it somewhere or recycle or to find some other thing that somehow she can use them. So I think, I don't want to idealize people in Ukraine or something, but I think even looking at some trends about growing up something in your house or recycle things or do something like this, I think it's very common among Ukrainians. Just for example, my granny used to recycle all the time, or whole life. So for us, it was okay to, you know, reuse something, some old bottles of water or something like this. Not throw away like food that you can, I don't know, give to like birds or something, etc. So probably we can find hope. You know, just with. Was like regular people who are trying to do, you know, maybe to change something or even to make their life comfortable. Yeah, but I'm not, you know, I'm just art historian. I'm not a specialist on like ecological topics, environment, and what's going on, like in terms of, for example, politics of the country. And I'm also an optimistic person, so I think that's my answer. And I'll try to also grow up something in my window, you know, at least try to do something like this and to learn from my granny how she does all those things in her village.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna try answering that in two parts. First is who given, not what, but probably, yeah, who, same as kind of you, I was talking about this, the kind of people that give you hope is the, for me, it's the ecological, environmental, like, community in Ukraine. And like, I know a lot of the people personally because I used to work in like environmental NGOs years ago back in Kyiv, and just seeing the kind of things they're doing now with like, for example, the work of ecologists like Alexei Burkovsky, who is like on top of like all of the environmental advocacy, is actually trying to, or has tried to put, recultivate the land, so take it out of its agricultural use and actually regenerate it. And I have so much admiration for him and everyone else who is trying to do this, because it's incredibly difficult in terms of legislation. Like, currently Ukrainian law makes it super difficult for you to do that. If you are like, I just want to convert this patch of agricultural land into a step, you have to jump through an infinite amount of legislative hoops. So the persistence that people are doing it despite like that being so difficult, that is incredible. And I think I would love for that process to be much easier. Also, not to romanticize just this kind of like step where plants grow on their own, but kind of thinking about how do we grow food in a way that is not toxic and damaging. So kind of how this place can be both the space for this native steppe vegetation and a place to like eat the food that is nice and not toxic. And the second part of the answer is kind of maybe more ironically something that gives me hope, but there's also very bleak in some ways. It's the work of another artist whom I don't think we've mentioned today yet, Dana Kavelina, who primarily works with animation. And a few days ago had a privilege of reading the scenario of the film that she's working on, and it's going to be out sometime, hopefully list this year. But that scenario just struck me so much. I'm not going to say like a huge amount of it, but just the thing that I wanted to mention about this in relation to hope is that there's a cow in there in the aftermath of an accident, and there's a soldier in the aftermath of an accident, and both of them are trying to grapple with the strangeness of the world that they are thrown in, and the kind of profound damage of in their own bodies and of the world around them. And it's in many ways, it's monstrous, it's overwhelming, it's bleak, but it's in that bleakness that I find something so honest about seeing the world as kind of what is happening, and without also dismissing the very beautiful things in there, because at some point there is the cow starts to moo and the stars start to moo back at it, and the whole world turns into this mooing cow symphony. And at some point, Kovala, the stipa feather grass, starts to shimmer. And it's the when I read like word shimmer, shimmer always brings me to the work of the incredible anthropologist Deborah Bird Rose, who has been working with indigenous like tribes in Australia. And there's a notion of shimmer and kind of life as shimmer, and this commitment to work that multiplies shimmer that I find so beautiful. And I think there is a lot of works that are not necessarily this kind of visible, obvious, recognizable art or kind of any specific, but it's also relational work of how we treat one another, how we are kind of, kind and good humans to one another in the whole world. And there is a lot of that work that multiplies the shimmer, and that is beautiful, and that gives me hope.
Thank you very much. I think that's a beautiful way to conclude this conversation. And I just want to thank you both so much for sharing all of these insights into your own work, your own lives, and Ukrainian ecologies more broadly. You've given us so much to consider about culture, art, history, and why they play such an important role in how people understand and view Ukraine from both the inside and outside. And to listeners of the podcast, this conversation is part one of a larger event on Ukrainian environmentalisms, which also explores how climate science, environmental policy, and green reconstruction can help Ukraine not only recover, but potentially emerge as a leader in sustainable development. So you'll hear from Anna Ackerman and Svetlana Krakowska in the next installment of the podcast. The podcast is brought to you by the Oxford Ukraine Hub, an interdisciplinary network connecting expertise across Oxford University with international researchers and practitioners working on Ukraine-related themes. Thank you so much for joining us.